Join with me in the reading of Scripture, Isaiah 58, 3 through 9. Isaiah 58, 3 through 9. Why have we fasted, and thou seest it not? Why have we humbled ourselves, and thou takest no knowledge of it? This is the voice of the people to God. And the answering voice of the prophet, or the voice of God, behold, in the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasures, and oppress all your workers. Behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with wicked fist. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice to be heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day for a man to humble himself? Is it to bow down his head like a rush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast and a day acceptable to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I choose? To loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry, and he will say, "Here I am." We live in a world, as we all know, that is beset by selfishness and greed. And the Bible tends to ask us many embarrassing questions about that kind of world and our life in that kind of a world. Hear the words to the first pair in the book of Genesis. Where are you? With the knowledge that one cannot hide from God. If I make my bed in Sheol or hell, thou art there. If I ascend into heaven, thou art there. Where are you? The second question is, what have you done that you cannot hide your actions from God? We know the question to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And the impertinent answer of Cain to God, am I my brother's keeper? And yet somehow we realize that we are embarrassed by that question. W. Harrison preached a great sermon one time on the text, how can I go up to my father if my brother go not with me? The question that Judah asked. How can we approach God if we have no concern for bringing our brother with us? The question asked of Jesus to one wanting to narrow religion, who is my neighbor? And the question in the parable of the great judgment in Matthew 25, when saw we thee hungry or thirsty? When did we visit thee in prison or minister to thee? If the Bible asks us embarrassing questions, the treasured documents of our nation also prove unsettling to us in our selfishness and greed. The very founding document, the one we celebrate on July the 4th, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, They're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Are the words of Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address that this government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Are the words we recite each time we pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It isn't just talking about our privileged group, it is talking about the whole of mankind. Are the words we inscribed on Lady Liberty in New York Harbor, our message on the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to live free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Thomas Jefferson, and this too is widely attacked in our day, proposed, as he had written in his Constitution in Virginia, that there be a wall of separation between church and state. And our Constitution says there shall be no religious test for office. And you look at every politician trying to prove his religious credentials, true or false, thinking that we have imposed some religious test for office. Let us turn now and look at this passage in Isaiah 58. Historically, this prophet is unknown by name. He is writing in the same time and area, I guess, as the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai and Zechariah had said, if we'll just rebuild the temple, if we'll just reinstitute sacrifice and the rituals of the temple, then the golden age will dawn. This prophet is looking at it in terms of our relationships to one another. The revival they had hoped for of religion or had preached hadn't produced the prosperity or the well-being that they desired. This great prophet saw the cause of this malaise in society as the failure to care for one another. We fasted, they said, and God didn't pay any attention. And he said, you fast only to abuse one another, to curse one another, to beat one another. It was the loss of compassion and respect for each person that was the problem. And he said, this is the fast that God chooses. God doesn't care whether I miss a meal, though I probably should miss a lot of them. But God does care about how we treat each other. I don't think God is all that interested in some of the rules and regulations, but God is interested in how we treat one of the least of these. You know, the basis of the judgment in that parable in Matthew 25 is, inasmuch as you did it unto one of the least of these, you did it unto me. Enter into the joy of your Lord. And those consigned to the outer darkness are those who did it not to one of the least of these. When saw we thee poor or hungry or in need? You know, there was quite a book and quite a lot of writing a few years ago about the invisible poor, that we had managed to focus only on our groups to the extent that we were totally unaware of the basic needs all around us. The needs of the immigrants, the needs of the people in New Orleans were suddenly flashed in our mind, and we saw people who needed everything. But basically we have in our mind said the poor are invisible. And we say quite honestly that we don't know anyone who is hungry or homeless. But it is because we have chosen to exile them from our mind behind the walls of our gated communities. There was a poem, and I was thinking about this as I was constructing this sermon. Let me live in a house by the side of the road where the race of men go by, the men who are bad, wise, the men who are bad, the men who are foolish, such as I. Men who are good, men who are bad, wise, foolish, such am I. How many people remember that poem? But when I was a child, I think everyone seemed to be able to recite that poem. Let me live in a house beside of the road and be a friend to man. Instead, we have even want to take our vacations in gated communities. We are afraid to drive through certain sections of our cities. We sell real estate on the basis of good schools, by which we mean basically the good schools don't offer as many free and reduced price lunches in the neighborhood, so that we are sealing ourselves off from one another. We turn away from the problems of the greater world, and we don't even report them in news. And we spend all our time watching Paris Hilton in and out of jail, rather than looking at the fact that there are 30, 40 million refugees from their own countries living in tents and squalor. We live in a world where the war on poverty has morphed into the war on the poor. Where the scandal on student loans. And, I saw this when I was teaching some, where they would bring in people who couldn't technically read or write, couldn't do so well enough that you could say they could, but they'd get them loans to keep the college afloat, and they would leave the school flunking out with great debt, but no better able to earn a living. The war on the poor, the lottery. Everyone knows that the lottery is played by the people who can't afford it, and that the money for education that they keep talking about on television promoting the lottery, that this goes to the people who probably can afford education or the lottery. Or we make ourselves feel good by joining together and building habitat houses. And yet one of the problems that habitat is running into, that people say, not in my neighborhood, the old acronym NIMBY. Don't build it near me. Don't build low-end housing near me. Don't build habitat homes near me. Even the people who are building the homes are acting that way. A war against one another. I'll take a moment and read the fine print on these credit card applications and credit cards they keep sending you, where they have all the power to change the terms and the interest rates and entrap you in a debt you can't pay. Or the subprime mortgage market that left over 1 million homes have been foreclosed on 1,300,000, and it was a fraud from the word go, where inflated values and so forth. I ride up and down the road and count the number of payroll lending firms where the interest rate may go up to 300 or more percent a year. Most bankruptcies that were occurring because of medical debt. So we made it not where people could face up to the fact that the medical costs were astronomical, but we made it more difficult to claim bankruptcy and start anew. And when you listen carefully to tax relief by the politicians, they quite often are using as a code word for a tax transfer, as we've recently seen in our state. I think we need to remember where we came from. I think the greatest generation, the people who are over 80 that remember the 1930s, have a great advantage over us. They remember a world where there was food in abundance, rotting in the fields, and animals being slain and burned, and people were hungry. We need to remember that failure of government to care for its citizens. The old Brooks Hayes story, the two old men talking about 1932, one saying, "Do you remember 1932? And the other said, "Sure I do." Said, "That was the year I broke my arm eating breakfast." And said, "Well, how'd you break your arm eating breakfast?" And he said, "Well, I fell out of a persimmon tree." Now, most of the younger ones wouldn't conceive of having to eat breakfast in a persimmon tree. And I can remember in my childhood when that seemed to be the best some people could do. The people walking the highway, stopping by and asking for food. And some, I remember the conversations in those preschool years, some people maintaining that they wouldn't give food to somebody that stopped by the house. And an old hard-nosed attitude that I'm going to determine whether or not, and I'm not going to share. They tell about one of these hard-nosed people that a man came by and wanted money for food, and the old hard-nosed man said, "Well, I don't give away money," but said, "I'll give you $10 if you'll paint my porch." So he gave him a bucket of paint and a brush. And a couple of hours later, the beggar reappeared, smeared with paint, the bucket in one hand and the brush in the other, and said, "Well, I'm finished," but said, "That wasn't a Porsche," said, "that was a BMW. We live in that kind of a world where we are not aware of the needs of one another, of the situation of one another. From telling tales, you know, I saw the people walking the streets in the 30s asking for food because they had none. And then when the build up for World War II began, suddenly everybody had jobs. They were available. Everybody was working. Everybody had money. They were declared what they never had been before, capable of doing jobs. One of my uncles, he came by, they declared that old rough-hewn farmer a carpenter building the military camps at Fort Jackson and elsewhere in the state. And he was telling about one of the other carpenters said he was throwing away half the nails. He said, "Why are you throwing away those nails?" And he said, "Well, they're pointed the wrong way." And the other carpenter farmer said, "You got it all wrong." He said, "Those nails are for the other side of the house, or the bearing." But we did have suddenly an ending of people, many people who were hungry. And I think we need to recognize the things that are going on to know one another. There's a deacon who was then up at West Gant. He's not there anymore. A young man who had known probably the struggles that are greater than most of us knew. And one of those dread appearances on Sunday mornings, our church time, this was happened to be a Sunday evening, you have the beggars show up and the wanting to see the preacher, and they know the preacher's got to get to his service, and asking for money. And this young deacon took the man aside and talked with him about his situation, about his life, prayed with him. And the man said, "Well, you know, I really was just begging, probably partially in anger. I don't really need the money." And he prayed with him, and the man said, "I'm going back to my home and try to make something of my life." But we don't want to get that involved. It's easier to give them a basket of food or a few dollars and pass them off. If Isaiah talked about this problem, the fact that we weren't associating with one another, we weren't knowing one another, we didn't know what was happening, he also talked about what God was expecting. This passage was chosen by Jesus in Luke 4. It's found in Isaiah 61. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because he has appointed me to preach good tidings to the poor, to affirm the worth of every person, to affirm that you are somebody because God has made you and Jesus died to redeem you." He said, "This is the task that's going to change the world, to comfort the brokenhearted." Jesus, one of the Beatitudes, is to comfort those who know sorrow and grief. To proclaim liberty to the captives, not forever thinking we make ourselves safe by putting people within prisons and walls, but liberty to the captives. The opening of the prisons, to believe again that lives can be changed by will and wisdom. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the year of Jubilee, the year that was enshrined in their Old Testament law. I don't think they ever kept it very well from my studies. But that a year when property was restored to people and they became landowners, they had property again. A year when the slaves were set free. A year when the land rejoiced because the slaves were set free. So your task, the task that God's Spirit lays upon you, is to empower the weak, to make strong the weak. God has sent us to proclaim freedom. And I think when we celebrate the 4th of July and celebrate where we came from and what we are, He has sent us to proclaim freedom as Christians and freedom within this land, not only for ourselves, but for all the people who know bondage. The great poet Louis Untermeyer, I think, sums it up better than I ever have, and I've used this poem many times. The prayer, he wrote this poem and called it prayer. "God, though this life is but a wraith, and we know not what we use, although we grope with little faith, give me the heart to fight and lose. Ever insurgent let me be, make me more daring than devout. From slick contentment keep me free, fill me with a buoyant doubt. Open my eyes to visions girt with beauty and with wonder lit, but let me always see the dirt and those that spawn and die in it. Open my ears to music. Let me thrill to spring's first flutes and drums, but never let me dare forget the bitter ballads of the slums. From compromise and things half done, keep me with stern and stubborn pride. And when at last the fight is won, God keep me still unsatisfied. Looking for the kingdom of God, a world that is better than the world we have known. Using our experiences to understand the needs of one another and the opportunities we have to help. This, I think, will be the renewal of the nation, the true revival that this prophet Isaiah proclaimed. Our hymn of decision is hymn number 591, Have Thine Own Way, Lord. If there's anyone here who would come committing themselves to this church or committing themselves to Christ and service here, you're invited to come as we sing hymn number 591.